You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 22nd of February 2014 on Monocle 24.
What's in a typeface, and why do certain covers become iconic? From the face to the times, we take stock of one very influential designer's career in print. As part of our special interview series On the Stack, this week we meet a man who has helped shape the look and style of print for decades. An in-depth interview this week on Edition 78 of The Stack, Monocle's print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to Studio 2 here at Midori House with me, Tyler Brûlé. Today, we're sitting down with a legend in typography. Neville Brody established his reputation working with record labels, magazines, and a range of international clients from Apple to Dom Perignon. Brash launches such as that of trendsetting magazine The Face in 1981 and later Arena, as well as radical redesigns for The Times, have given Neville Brody an astonishing reputation amongst the design world. Neville has produced scores of new fonts that have never failed to raise a few eyebrows in what can be a very shackled section of the design world. A great believer in the public function of design, Neville has collaborated with other typographers to invest in the understanding of his craft. In 1990, he set up a typeface library with fellow master and previous Monocle 24 guest Eric Speakerman. Never happy to rest on his laurels, Neville founded design agency Research Studios in 1994 and went on to redesign the new logo for the BBC and made his mark on the visual language of Hollywood too, through work for clients such as Paramount Studios. Neville is also an academic and is the current head of communications at London's Royal College of Art. And welcome, Neville Brody, to Studio 2 here at Midori House. It's been a long time. I have to think back to, goodness, the early days, certainly. I never was a contributor to The Face, but had a bit of a run, certainly, with a couple of different regimes at Arena over the years. I don't know where we want to start. I mean, we can sort of reminisce about the late 80s and early 90s. But I'm wondering if we should maybe get right up to speed. And certainly we were talking about in the intro, you're in the academic world. Everyone looks at this city and this country, and even of course the government has the good sense to talk up the fact that the creative industry, the creative arts are incredibly important, often a little bit difficult to measure as an industry in terms of total exports, partly because it's talent too, and talent is such a huge part of this. So if we were to venture across the park over to the Royal College, what are the state of things right now when you look at the talent pool of people that are coming in? Because my sense oftentimes when I go to schools in this city and you do the odd speech here and there is that a lot of international faces, great international talent, and sometimes there's this worry, is that what the government's also chasing? Or is there still a good upsurge of good old British talent too?
Essentially, the UK is no longer a manufacturing nation, but what we manufacture is image and we manufacture content. What's happening with the government right now is that they're making it very hard for people to go into creative education, and not only making it hard, but also trying to, I guess, bias people against the idea of doing creative industry. They're coming out of very much a kind of an industrial engineering, technology, science, and they think that all of this is going to save us, but actually it's not. What they're missing here is the real secret, which is we are a nation of inventors. Monocle is a great invention. I think The Face was a great invention at the time. And it's quite interesting for me actually being right here because, you know, Arena was born like two blocks from here. Mm. And Arena and The Face were born out of a small entrepreneurial back room. And actually when we launched Arena, people said, you know, what are you doing expanding? And we said, no, we're staying open later. And you know that story.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the problem in education right now is that there are year on year less applicants coming from the UK, which is, I think, a tragedy. It's not a tragedy in the sense that the quality is dropping because we're getting amazing kind of applicants from outside the UK. But the government is making it so hard for those people to stay or even come in So as soon as their degree is finished, the government is asking them to leave again. So what's happening here in the UK is there's a diminishing pool of future creative entrepreneurs.
Mm. Now, where are they going? We were getting fewer applicants. Doesn't mean that people aren't interested in going into this design world. Is it a case then, if I grew up in Newcastle or if I was up in Glasgow, I'm sending my application somewhere else or I'm going to a lesser institution? What's happening?
Well, two things are happening. One, you're not going to an institution at all. At £9,000 a year and your employment prospects are fairly low and there's no way to borrow that money, to be honest, you're not going to do anything. Or the other thing is, if you are going to go into education, you're going to think about something that's to do with vocational, professional, trade, that might guarantee you a job, even though that's a kind of fallacy in itself. So I think the job of the next government, which clearly will replace this one, will be to move us back to the idea that we're a creative nation. Mm. You know, you think about the Beatles, David Hockney, even James Dyson is a product of art school. I'm not sure if you did.
Not art school, journalism school.
But journalism is also frowned upon by this government. It's in the same boat.
Sure.
It's arts and humanities.
Yeah.
And we may not be sitting here today. If we were trying to get into education now, in 20 years, we wouldn't be sitting here.
This government and the next government, have they seen a memo? Has a memo been sent out? Is there an awareness here? Because also, you know, we're talking about a story which is not just playing out in this country either. I think that we can look at other Commonwealth nations and many other places that it's the same story of, yeah, belt tightening. How can we get people out into the workforce faster, guaranteed jobs, but at the same time, no real sense of a foundation either.
No, but as I said, I think the UK was always a nation of inventors, you know, from the hovercraft to the Dyson to the whatever. And our job was never really kind of to make the stuff, but it was to start the stuff or think of it. Apple, for instance, currently has somewhere in the region of 500 designers, of which the majority are trained in the UK. So we are great.
Is that because Jonathan Ive has a fast track, well, probably also with the immigration services in the US to get all of his friends and mates over there? Or is there something that is flowing through the bloodstream in this country
it's
as well?
It's flowing through the bloodstream. I know that they have a far larger recruitment approach in the UK than anywhere else. They're trying to identify young creators out of the UK and bring them to the US because they feel that in the US, the system there doesn't produce the same kind of thinking. So we have that amazing thing, the thing, again, that produces the face, Arena, Monocle, wallpaper. Those things can't happen in other places. And you have to start actually investing in that space.
Mm. Let's rewind to the days when you were marching around Marylebone as well. And it's incredible even just how this immediate neighborhood has transformed, you know, many different times. The state of starting a magazine, if you look back then, as you said, you know, keeping certainly the lights on a little bit longer, doing what, you know, what had to be done. Has the process changed? I'm not just saying from a design point of view and what's sitting on people's desks, etc., but also the business of it. Do you think there was a different type of entrepreneurialism, or is it pretty much the same, you know, now as it was then?
Well, there was a sense, certainly in the 80s, that you could just do stuff. You could get up in the morning, stay in your bedroom and make something brand new, you know, be it a fanzine or a T-shirt or a new piece of clothing design or a new song. The idea was that there was a kind of do-it-yourself mentality and that somehow you'd figure it out as you were going along. This country very quickly understood that this was a threat to kind of big industry.
Mm.
So they tended to put in place several control mechanisms, so distribution channels, for instance, and then outlets as you become more supermarketized. So you end up at Angel. I mean, I love magazines. I think that as we move towards kind of a more ephemeral and faster, I guess, consumption of information, the magazine still sits there and you can just flick back and then read and then mark something you want to come back to later. And it's a beautiful object. It's a beautiful item. But getting hold of that becomes a more elitist approach. So it's only going to be a certain strata of society that'll be even interested in this.
Mm.
I mean, not in the same way that people that really love music still buy vinyl, but we're moving close to that sort of thing. So at Angel, in Chapel Market, there's not one news agent. There's no outlet. There's a small stand on the corner of Liverpool Road. You can't browse, so you need to know what you're going to buy in advance. which means unless you're in the know, you're not in the know.
And there's no sense of discovery. I think the one thing you constantly come back to wasn't the great thing about going to newsstands. And of course, you know, there are still a few good ones in this city, but was knowing that you had, if I think back to 89, 1990, 1991, when I had 30 or 40 pounds in my pocket, knowing that I was going to go in there and I was going to spend all of it, and I might still, you know, owe the news agent 3 or 4 more pounds, but we'd sort it out next time. And there was that true sense of really finding interesting things that were new. You had an upsurge then, of course, just more international magazines coming into the country, maybe not sort of the proliferation then of so many new sort of self-published launches. But it was, you know, it was an incredibly exciting and remarkable time. And I think that when you sort of talk about those mechanisms, is part of it as well, even the way we think about cities, the way we think about our high streets in this country, the supermarketization, as you say, in many ways, you know, the market has been created in a way to make it easier if you're a Tesco or one of these big players. And it's very hard if you're Mr. Singh or Mr. Smith running your small independent newsstand to still make a go of it. And obviously, probably Mr. Smith or Mr. Singh are going to sort of take a punt on variety, where the big brands, they only want to stock sure bets.
Yeah, they only want to stock the top 20.
If that...
If that. Well, yeah. Well, you know, it's the top 10 games, top 10 DVDs, top 10 magazines, top 10 newspapers, top 10 fruits.
Yeah, it's
top
true.
10 cuts of meat. I mean, yeah. You know, they're not going to invest in more indigenous, interesting, localized, or fraction publishing. But at the same time, I don't think we've been in a healthier space in terms of the broad base of magazine publishing. There are so many independent magazines out there right now. Some of which may sell 500. I mean, God knows how they survive. But there seems to be a drive that this is actually a really interesting space. And there seems to be generally, I think magazines are always ahead of the high street. And generally, there's a trend now, I think, in the high street, away from the supermarket to a local boutique. So even again, coming back to Angel, there's new butchers, there's new fish shops, there's new local cheese shops. There's all these kind of more localized quality, and they're a little more expensive. But there's a different kind of caring space, and it's a kind of cultural shift, I think, that we've seen happening in magazines and is now translating to other spaces.
We're talking to Neville Brody here on the 78th edition of The Stack here on Article 24. We're going to take a very, very short break, though. We'll be back after this.
The February issue of Monocle will help you plot your global progress in 2014. Turn the pages to find the villages, cities, and nations you need to visit for inspiration, work, and play. Whether you're looking for a new HQ, want to get that movie made, or perhaps are a spy, we'll tell you how to plan your itinerary.
In the affairs section, we visit two African islands you've probably never been to, Comoros and Mayotte. We take a look at Geneva's diplomatic credentials ahead of the Syria talks, and there are also interviews with leaders from Washington, Belgrade, and Buenos Aires.
In the business section, we find out where to launch your next startup and find inspiration, from Lisbon to Monterey. Then, big oil and small business might not be natural bedfellows, but in the Texas city of Houston, they're getting along famously. We meet the new generation shaping the city's future.
In culture, we're looking forward to 2014 by telling budding arts-inclined entrepreneurs the best places to shoot their film, sell their paintings, and make TV. Plus, a report from Mexico City, home of the world's finest new museum. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
And it is a Saturday here in London, and we are talking to Mr. Neville Brody, and you're, of course, listening to The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. Just before we went to our break, Neville, you're talking about the sense of certainly the international and that sense of utility, but also I think that, you know, that this critical role that print still plays, and not just print, you know, the good old magazine. If we look back at late 80s, early 90s, was the newsstand what inspired you as a designer, someone who was so invested in the editorial world? Was it as international? Were you looking at as many influences? If a copy of Père Louis came in, was there really an interest in looking at sort of early details from the States? Or do you think it's even more so now? Because despite everything that's happened in print, there's still more magazines now than there were then. You know, maybe a few more rose to the top or had a bigger voice at that time. But how does it feel, you know, today versus then?
Well, back in the 80s, the only place you could buy international magazines was on Old Compton Street. That was it.
Yeah.
And you would have to go there, seek it out. And it was just like a traditional news agents, but they had every magazine in the world, and it was the most amazing space. And you didn't go in because you'd bankrupt yourself for the next month. Nowadays, they're much more available, so they're widely distributed, but to less outlets. Mm. So you'll find that the few outlets that are not supermarkets tend to sell all the international magazines.
Mm.
And anywhere you go in the world, in fact, I find English magazines or British magazines or English language magazines easier to buy in Tokyo.
Absolutely.
Or San Francisco.
Yeah.
That you can't find on the streets here. So there's this kind of strange flip that's going on. At the time, international magazines, when we were beginning the face, were not particularly inspirational. There wasn't that much around. And that quickly flipped. So, you know, like the Père Louis or Italian Vogue or stuff tended to then become sources of inspiration for other areas like beauty. I mean, we didn't understand that stuff. And then in New York, you had this different kind of underground art culture. So we didn't understand that stuff. Mm. So all of this stuff kind of became this potpourri of melting pot of influences. But what the UK did was it managed to take that and turn that into a bold statement, pulling all of those things together. There isn't the same sense of, I guess, centres where those things can happen now. I mean, Monocle's doing a grand job, of course. I know that the kind of the feel of Monocle is pretty much aligned to what an online experience might be, where you kind of dip in, grab certain stories. There's an attention deficit problem so that the length of story gets shorter, etc. So we're used to this kind of browsing, and then you've where Monocle started, I remember the story's been much longer. And now they're more kind of bite-sized. So it's about fitting in with the lifestyle. And the influences in Monocle are worldwide. I mean, this is almost a newsagent on Old Compton Street in itself, where you pull all these things together. So it's not so much about the Face magazine, which was celebrating London culture, UK culture, and then broadcasting it to the world. It's kind of flipped now, and it's about, I guess, collectors that go out and spot interesting things and then bring them back. So we're back to a kind of cultural safari model.
Does London feel more international or more of a beacon now versus then? And I think back to the role that the Face had and certainly early on in Arena, where you would see, and certainly that relationship, and you mentioned Tokyo, the relationship that existed between London and Tokyo then, just this incredible, you know, the kids that you would see coming from Japan, and maybe they were easier to spot then, I don't know, but I got that sense then that, you know, all eyes were on the city, and because it was London, and yes, the Face became more international as it grew up, etc., but it was, the story was here.
Well, there was a tribalism, and there were different tribes, not like kind of online groups, which are very different, but there was a tribalism and tribes connected and yet identified themselves. And because there was a chance for things to, I guess, incubate and gestate and develop before they were known by the public, things had more depth when you touched them. Nowadays, things grow up in public. So, you know, we've just had this great exciting new band play with a new music thing, and then it's tweeted, and then 2 weeks later everyone knows about it, and a week later it's dead.
A magazine, you know, the Face in its day, Arena Day, in its day, was you know, a defining badge, and it was physical, and it was as important as the Timberland ankle boot that you had at that time, you know, the chippy denim that you were wearing, whatever it was, you know, it was very much, you know, this is also my badge, and my media is a badge. And as you're saying, there's that sense of utility today with so many of these things. Well, you know, everyone is on a particular social media channel. It doesn't really say much about you in the same way that a mobile phone doesn't really say much about you because you only have four different brands to choose from. But there is something intellectual, occasionally political, about a great piece of print. Going back to the memos, do you think a lot of the big media companies understand that today?
Well, the big media companies are... See, what happened is that there's a homogenization. As the pool gets bigger, the need to flatten it out gets bigger. So Starbucks is the same in every country. And what they do is they tend to replace local flavor. Because for Starbucks, you can't afford to have a million different possibilities. You have to flatten it, otherwise you can't distribute successfully. It's not an economic model. So the idea of all of this, social media, internationalization, globalization, it becomes kind of generic. Because any other model, you can't distribute successfully financially. So what happens then is people need to find these other outlets for these individual things. Magazines are one of the few things that remain. And then people that will self-publish their own music, for instance, is one of those spaces. So the memo's gone out that individualism should be supported, but the people that are in power to which the memos have gone to have defined this as their new space that they need to own. So it's somehow it's a kind of guise of individualism. You know, if you tweet something interesting, again, you're right, what does that say?
Mm.
I had an argument with someone last night who said, why aren't I tweeting all the time? And I said, well, for what? I mean, just to be broadcast. So so there's kind of culture that's developing that's permanently being broadcast and instantly being broadcast. And there's a whole generation that doesn't understand that as you continually broadcast, you're not letting things develop. And your sense of individualism is, and the cycle gets faster and faster.
Let's move away from that crazy treadmill. And if we went down to Old Compton Street with you right now, went into Librairie Parisienne, one of the still one of the great newsstands in this city, what are you picking up? What's Neville Brody reading right now? Or at least even just flicking through?
Well, to be honest, very little. There are a few interesting experimental art magazines going on. But not much that's going to grab me to pick it up these days. Well, how about you, Tyler?
What am I picking up?
Yeah.
A lot, actually. And it's, you know, to me, I still love the experience of going to, I still like going to the newsstand. So I was in, I was in Paris earlier in the week, you know, and in Germany. So, you know, I wanted to look at, of course, what was going on in you know, German architecture. So and I was thinking about my train ride. So I grabbed a copy of Detail because I just I just love the mechanical drawing on the cover and that they've stuck to that. And I feel that this is a magazine that doesn't feel it's had to sort of reinvent itself. You know, there it is for me. On the other side, then I bought German Architectural Digest. I read that probably competitively. I want to see, of course, you know, what advertisers are in there as much as you want to see some interesting interiors. The graphic design Novum found its way into my tote bag
Well. These are all quite niche.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
and you know, you're a niche consumer who has also a niche business, and so you're going to be attracted to those niche titles. I mean, me too.
Mm.
In terms of general titles, absolutely not.
No.
Very little out there. So the niche is the interesting thing. So this is what I'm talking about. This...
What's happened to your, and obviously you have a great background with newspapers as well. What's happened with your newspaper consumption?
Zero.
Has not changed, or you're not a consumer?
No. I'm not a consumer of newspapers anymore. Mm. I consume news.
Sure.
Heavily, but through multiple channels.
Yeah.
And I don't rely on one particular source for that.
Mm.
The Guardian Online, I tend to end up more than anywhere else. But generally speaking, the printed thing is, it becomes a burden. And I was thinking about that this morning. If you go to Angel in the morning and no one can buy a magazine anymore, but everyone's picking up Metro or The Standard or whatever. And there's this kind of blandness. So, in fact, we're moving away from these niche publishing opportunities. So it's quite refreshing. So you might go to Magma, for instance, and buy there. But this again, it's niche. So you might buy Fishing Weekly or you might buy Car Monthly or... It's the niche magazines that still have the interest for me. I don't know if you've come across, we've been working on a magazine recently called The New British.
No, I haven't come across it.
Which I will share with you. And it's working with someone who used to be an illustrator called Kez Glozier. And it's a fascinating magazine that Kez was inspired by Sunday Times magazines from the 60s and 70s, and what great publishing things they were. And those were mass, but yet niche and quality.
And just for our listeners, what part of the market does it fill? What's it saying editorially, politically?
It's saying that we're missing a really good space where reportage, art, design and music can live together. And right now you would have only one of those things.
Mm.
And even reportage isn't effectively being delivered anymore.
No.
So where do you go? And how do you deliver all of that with a kind of political awareness and get great quality writers and photographers in to be part of that? So somewhere there's a real market, I think, for that kind of level of specialism that has at heart quality editorial.
Mm. Neville Brody, really great to see you. We could have turned this into a one-week special. I'm looking through the glass at our producer for today, David Pleasant, and we should definitely think about that. Thanks very much for being on the program today.
Thank you, and let's hope the government gets behind the Royal College and all the other art students.
Absolutely. That brings us to the end of the 78th edition of The Stack with me, Tyler Burley. As I said, David Pleasant was today's producer, and also the woman behind the glass back from New Zealand is Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time, and of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes. But for now, for me, goodbye.